Welcome to the Talking Writing Podcast. I'm John Vogel, TW's creative director. For today's interview, I sat down with drummer and author Nick Brown. I was pointed to Nick's memoir, Bang Bang Crash, by Tom McAllister, who knew Nick from the Iowa's Writers' Workshop. Nick played in a long list of bands, including his high school pop group, Anthenaeum, and the rock group Skeleton Key, headed by bassist Eric Sanko. This episode is scored with the album The Early Years, the first recording of Nick's band, Falcon. One thing I wanted to ask you about off the bat, because I have a fair amount of connection to the Raleigh music scene, to that area, because our band used to have a good following there. So we would play at like King's and the Poorhouse and Slim's a lot.
Sure.
Yeah, that was like one of our constant stops that we would do. In fact, I'm going to be there for Hopscotch for a day party
awesome.
in just a couple weeks. I wanted to see, you were around at like an earlier time period than we were generally going down there though. Cause we probably started in like 2007 to 2000, right. Like 15 was our time period. How do you feel about the, you know, if you could just, I guess, go into like your experience with, specifically that area and like what it means to you. Cause I know you had a lot of, stuff in the book about growing up there and also, coming back to the Chapel Hill music scene and meeting a bunch of people that were like, you know, heroes at the time. Yeah.
Yeah, man. I mean, so I grew up in Greensboro, which is in the center of the state, North Carolina. And it's a pretty quiet town. It's a great town, really. But there, you know, there wasn't much going on, especially when I was growing up in the, you know, 80s, early 90s. I was in high school 91 to 95. And right then was really the height of when the Chapel Hill music scene was exploding with it's sort of incredibly wide variety of bands. You know, it did not have an aesthetic identity, right? You know, I mean, if you think about the big bands that came out at the time, I mean, would really be like, well, Superchunk, and they were running Merge out of Chapel Hill. And then Ben Folds 5, of course, was having huge hits. Squirrel Nut Zippers, right? You know, all of them were sort of like top of the heap. And then it was like, I mean, there was this feeling like if you started a band and were pretty good, like you were gonna get a record deal. And it was a different era, you know, when it was important for me to move from Greensboro to Chapel Hill. I felt like I was moving to the center of the cultural world, really, you know, because and I'm sure you remember this feel of like idolizing regional bands, right? And we, you know, the regional scene was still just so intense. So my favorite bands were from Chapel Hill. You know, I mean, there's this band, The Sex Police, and it was like, they were my favorite band. And their singer ended up producing the first record of my like high school band. And I was like, I'm done. My dreams have come true. You know, I remember when that band signed a record deal with Atlantic And I remember our A&R person saying, like, what are your goals? And I was like, I just want to be as big as the Sex Police. And you could see this look on his face. He's like, I think we can make some bigger goals, Nick, you know? He's like, right. Whatever, man. But I didn't go to college out of high school. You know, I just moved to Chapel Hill and was there in the music scene. And, you know, that was my aesthetic education, and it was amazing. It was amazing. I mean, it just, things felt so electric there.
Mm-hmm. For me, we had a house that we ran a venue out of, and I feel like that was my formative, like, aesthetic experience of just, like, seeing tons of bands in my basement. And it really, like, seeing all those bands really shaped, like, how I approach live music, especially. How do you feel like it influenced you going forward? And do you feel like you're still, like, kind of reaching back to that, at least mentally?
Well, you know, part of what was going on in Chapel Hill and probably at the house that you were in is bands inspiring each other, right?
Yeah.
And so for me, like, looking back at that time, it was really like me thinking about when I was learning a lot, because I was younger than a lot of the guys that I was sort of looking up to. You know, I was a young guy, and I was in a band that was really good, but sort of aesthetically, like, you know, I mean, we were mostly a pop band, and we were super earnest and really good at our instruments, but the bands in Chapel Hill were so sophisticated. And those guys, there was a real level of sophisticated artistic depth and education. And so for me, it was like being in that scene wasn't just about learning about music. It was like getting a subscription to Harper's, you know? Mm-hmm. It was learning, like, that I should read James Salter, you know? It was getting into Carolina basketball. It was learning who good painters were. So it was like, it was just this depth of education because of the people I was around. And, you know, I mean, you look back, and this is probably the same way you feel, but, like, looking back, it's not about the music so much for me as it is about the people that I got to hang around with. And people who go all in on a music career are a specific, you know, personality type. And mm-hmm. they bring just an intoxicating energy, especially at that age. And so I look back at that time, it's just sort of the root of my, like, artistic education, which continued then when I went to New York, especially with Eric Senko, with Skeleton Key, who you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I'm in touch with a lot of those guys all the time still. And it was just a great time for me to expand my horizons, you know?
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the pop aesthetic and Skeleton Key, who Eric Senko heads, part of my most fond memory of hanging out with Eric Senko after we played with Skeleton Key at our house was him mentioning that he was in the Lounge Lizards. And I was like, the Lounge Lizards with John Lurie? Like, I love totally. Fishing with John. But it brings up for me a question of, like, the difference between, like, the pop to weird continuum of music, and an outlying question for me is always, like, what is the is there, like, a fundamental difference in the crowds that go to these shows? Because I'm dealing with that now, like, putting together bills and stuff for shows, where it's like, do I want to go, like, do I want to lean more on the pop side? Do I want to lean more on the, like, weird and abrasive side, you know? And what kind of a difference is that going to make in the people who show up, you know, and how many people show up to this show? So, and since you've had sort of, like, a, like, experience on both sides of the coin, what has been your experience with, like, the difference between the pop side and the weird side of music?
I have a lot of different answers, right? But you're asking about the crowd, first of all, which is something that I've thought about a lot, because I was in the pop band that we're talking about was a band that I formed, you know, in eighth grade with my best friends. And we played through high school and got a big record deal right out of high school. And, you know, for me, my relationship with the crowds that were coming to pop shows got to be really complicated. It was all in my head, right? Mm-hmm. And it got to be a point where I was like, you know, I wasn't as into the music anymore. And I knew it was a problem when I'd go to a club and look at the crowd and be like, why are you people into this music? Like, I'm not into it. You know, I like, what are you doing here? And that's when I knew, like, okay, this is a bad dynamic, right? Because there's nothing wrong with the people who were coming to the show. You know, that's just what they were into. It was my issue. But at the same time, what it was really about was me just looking to surround myself with more people that I was interested in their aesthetic, you know, sensibility. I was a fan of Skeleton Key. And so when I met Eric, I was so excited to be able to work with him. And it was really exciting to interact with the people that were interested in that band. Because once again, it was a recreation of what I was feeling in Chapel Hill, where, like, for the most part, they were all a million times, like, smarter and cooler and more sophisticated than me. You know, Athenaeum shows were huge, and we had tons of people there, and it was great. Skeleton Key shows were smaller, but, you know, you mentioned John Lurie, like, you know, a Skeleton Key show, you know, I remember playing and, like, in the front row is Jim Jarmusch and John Lurie, right? That's not, you know, in the front row at an Athenaeum concert is like my ex-girlfriend from seventh grade Spanish class and like some neighbors. And so, like, again, I think I was like, I was just still on a great trajectory of chasing that rush of being sort of a perpetual aesthetic student. And it really helped when later in life, and as part of me writing my memoir, we played an Athenaeum reunion concert. And in my mind, I was still thinking about the crowd as like these 18-year-olds, you know? And it was so great to get there. And I was like, oh, like everybody here is totally cool. And they're all grown up and like just as sophisticated as any of us. And it just like, it really helped me sort of come to terms with this like thing in my head where like, how do I deal with people that are more passionate about an artistic project that I was in than I ended up being, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's an interesting question. But, you know, for me, I just tried to keep finding something I was like excited about artistically and also like a little uncomfortable with, you know, I mean, Skeleton Key definitely pushed me in new technical like worlds. You've seen Skeleton Key play, like at the time I was playing with them, I was the only drummer, so I had regular drums on the ground and then trash all up here, so I was sort of playing two drum parts, and it was great. I mean, it made me such a better drummer, and I got a ton of work out of that, right? Like, I just met a whole world of musicians in downtown New York through Eric that I wouldn't have otherwise if I'd stayed in North Carolina.
Those who have ears should listen. And those who have eyes should read. Acknowledge the Rosenfeld.
Speaking of, you know, the Skeleton Key shows being smaller, I feel like a very definitely a marker of my experience, and I feel like it's really common with a lot of people, is like just the common experience of playing empty shows or clearing rooms. I'm wondering, do you feel like you skipped that because you had such like success right at the beginning of your career. Because I mean, and I feel like it's the regular trajectory is like empty shows until you build a following, and then you might have like a moment of popularity, and then you go back to empty shows as people stop paying attention. You know,
that's a great point. Yeah.
And that definitely isn't exactly what I experienced, but there is some of that. I just wonder what your experience has been with like uncomfortable crowdless shows or people leaving during your set and stuff.
So you make a great point that, you know, I'd experienced success early, and then after that sort of like came into gigs as sort of like a session guy with a lot of bands that were already sort of like, you know, had it going on. You know, I mean, I said Skeleton Key shows were smaller, but Skeleton Key already had like an identity and people coming to shows.
Right.
But, you know, I played tons of those shows where nobody was there, though. When Athenaeum was coming up, we toured nonstop. And most of that was when I was in high school, which also, I think, insulates you to the thing of like people leaving. I was like, whatever, like, oh, we're in Florence, South Carolina. Like, this is great. You know, I didn't know what was good or not. I was just with my friends and we'd gotten out of town. And so I don't think I had as much of that, like, man, what am I doing with my life? You know, in an empty room with nobody there. And man, I hadn't thought about it that way, but yeah, I'm sort of glad I missed that. You know, I did early tours with Long Wave too. That's a band in New York that I recorded their second record with. And it, like, even before their first record, they had an independent record and I was already touring with them then. And those shows were small and had some empty rooms, but they were really like on the trajectory up. So even when those rooms were small or it's sparsely populated, it was super exciting because everybody knew like something's happening, you know. So yeah, I've been lucky, you know, definitely, for sure.
Yeah, because I feel like it that just made me think of do you know Fantomas, the Mike Patton project?
Yeah,
because I remember when I first saw them in like 1999 when they came out with their first record, and you know, they were playing tiny shows. Like they played like 100-cap club with that was like half full when I saw them for the first time. And it was like, oh, wow, these are, you know, the dude from Slayer, from, you know, two people from Mr. Bungle and Faith No More. And then Buzz Osborne from, you know, these like veterans of like super, super established bands. And they're playing for like a very sparse crowd in like Pittsburgh, you know.
Totally, I bet that show was amazing.
Oh yeah, it was. It was one of my their show there and their show at the TLA, and you know, and then I saw them a couple of years later, like at the TLA to a packed crowd, and it's like, oh, there are like 1,000 people here. So both of those shows still stand out as like one of my formative like peak experience shows of being in an audience and just being like, holy shit, like this is awesome. You know,
well, you know, it's funny when like I've done book tours, I've thought about a lot about, you know, the difference between doing a reading and a show. And like, you know, readings are super bleak if nobody's there, right? Because you're like there quietly reading this thing. And it has made me look back and sort of remember great shows where nobody was there. It's like, at least in a band, you're on stage with your friends and like active and doing something. But yeah, man, there's nothing worse than a reading when there are like two people there. That's the depth of the sort of like difficult roomness.
Right. Yeah, because I mean, it's kind of like stand-up comedy where there's nothing between, you know, there's nothing between you and the audience. It's just like you talking directly to an audience.
Totally.
Yeah. I also had a question about youth in music, because it's like you have a line in the book. I'm going to paraphrase because I didn't copy and paste it, but there's a line in the book about like about it being a young person's dream to be in a band. And what does it mean when you're an adult and trying to chase that young person's dream? Something along those lines. And, you know, I think about this a lot, like music being something that you pursue as a child when you're young, and then you grow out of it and you get out of it. And I feel like I have never gotten out of it, and it still remains like the thing that I want to do the most, you know?
Sure.
You know, so I just want to see, as, you know, from your perspective now, what is your relationship between youth and music and following the passion of trying to create music and play for people?
Well, it changes all the time, right? Like, just in the way that our sort of relationship with our younger self changes as our current self changes, I guess, if I can put it that way. You know, what I said in the book was, I wasn't making a statement about, it was an individual statement, right? Like, my dreams, I realized that my dreams as a young, you know, as a boy had come true, but I was no longer a boy, right? And therein lies, and, you know, I think that we all encounter that in different ways, whether it's music or just interest, you know, being in love with something and falling out of love. It's just, you know, that in a way, just me writing about sort of like aging, maturing, and just changing. But, you know, like, it's important for me now to listen to new music every day, right? Mm-hmm. And part of that is trying to not let that part of my brain stay in the same sort of musical place that it was when I first like became passionate about music. And so I guess the reason I'm bringing that up is I think, like, in a way, I'm still trying to recreate like that youthful like excitement about music and just sort of like trying to listen to uncomfortable stuff, you know, stuff I'm not familiar with. And that continues to be important to me. And, you know, a different answer to that question is, part of the reason that I wrote this book is I had a very successful career playing drums, and then I'd gotten to this place where my friends, my colleagues, my neighbors, like, most people didn't know I played a musical instrument, like, at all, let alone had a successful career doing it. And just that alone was weird, right? And I, like, as a writer, I know if something is a little bit weird and I can't figure it out, like, it's probably a good thing to write about. And people will say, like, you know, writing memoir is not, you know, it's not therapy, right? Like, this is not an exercise in therapy. And I absolutely agree. At the same time, I have a much better, like, relationship to my past and present as a musician after having written this book than I did beforehand. So I've been playing a lot more, and I'm really happy about that.
It's funny to me that your story kind of conforms to, like, exactly the dream that young people would have of getting into music, right? Like, because I feel like there is this story that's sold to us by most mainstream music media of like the making it, the getting discovered and making it big story, that is sold to a lot of young people, that a lot of, you know, most, the vast majority of people who get into the music sort of don't experience that and end up either getting disillusioned and quitting, or getting disillusioned and being like, well, I still want to do this, so, like, how am I going to make it work?
Yeah.
I wonder what are your thoughts about, like, how that story is sold to young people and the reality of how it works out for most people, also in contrast to how it worked out for you?
Right. Well, I will say, you know, two things about how it worked out for me. One is that I'm just lucky I met Mark Cano, who's the singer and songwriter in Athenaeum. The guy's insanely talented, right? Like, mm-hmm. I'm a very good drummer, but, like, that's all I would have done in Greensboro, you know. So I met Mark super early, and we had great chemistry. And so, like, it, you know, hat off to him for making this happen. Also, it was that era where, you know, of course, the music industry was different. You know, major labels were running the show. And there was a real touring scene in the Southeast at the time. And so, you know, we recorded a self-titled CD, right? Mm-hmm. And sold 10,000 copies by ourselves, just touring at shows out of the back of the van. And so, like, yes, we were discovered by a major label, but it was also, they were like, there was no risk. They're like, they're going to sell 10,000 copies by themselves. Like, we might as well sign them. We can definitely sell more. And so, like, it was, you know, and not just luck, but it was lucky timing-wise for us and for me that I just, like, found an incredibly talented partner. But, you know, the other thing, and I talk about my students today because I teach creative writing with, is, like, the main takeaway I have about success in the arts, whether it's music or writing, is it's not the most talented people who have success. It's the people who don't stop, you know? So, like, I mean, I remember bands back in the day and just thinking, like, if you guys didn't break up, like, give it one more year, you're gonna be successful. It's like all the bands that I thought of that had success at the time were just the bands that stayed together, you know? And with writing too, I know so many writers who are so much better than I am, or some of my friends who just, you know, I don't want to do this. They took a real job and just sort of, you know, maybe they'll get back into it. But, you know, part of it is just sticking with it and finding a way. And that way changes over time, right? Like, yeah, you know, I had a record deal with Atlantic Records in the 90s. That, you know, that's not going to happen now if I wanted to do it again. You know, now it's like Clemson is subsidizing my artistic career. You know, I don't make a ton on like book advances or royalties. And so, like, the just that arrangement of what it means to be a successful artist, it just changes over the years. But for me, it's like just all about not quitting. Another thing I'll say, I was really lucky, yes, that Athenaeum had success when I was young. But like one of the main takeaways for me is that it made a career in the arts seem perfectly normal, you know? Mm-hmm. So like, sure, I'll stop playing drums and like I'll start writing short stories, you know, like the worst career path ever. But like it didn't, you know, I was like, well, sure, like I'll make it work, you know? And you think about Eric from Skeleton Key, right? Like he sort of found more success after Skeleton Key working as a puppet maker, you know, even a worse career path than going from drumming to writing fiction, you know? But just that idea. And again, it's something I tell my students here in South Carolina, like it can seem impossible and crazy to pursue a career in the arts. And it's not. There are thousands, millions of us who are making it happen. You just sort it out. And what that success looks like changes.
I actually said something very similar to Tom after our interview here. I was like, sometimes, you know, it just seems like just continuing to do it and not quitting is its own form of success. You know?
Oh, totally. Totally. Yeah. So I was talking about that with my close friend, Darren Jesse, who he played drums in Ben Folds Five, which is how most people know him. But he's a great songwriter, too. And I went to see him. He was playing a solo show a few months ago. Just acoustic guitar and singing. And he just keeps putting out records, right? But the lighting in the club, it was like a blue light or something. It made all of his hair look completely gray. And I had this image of him of like, oh my God, like if you just keep playing a club show like this with 30 of us here for another 20 or 30 years, like you are going to be a legend just because you've kept doing it. You know, I saw this like grizzled version of Darren from the future and I was like, you know, I could feel people saying like, oh man, like that's Darren Jesse. Like he's still doing it. You know, I played with some older people. I played with Michael Hurley a little bit who had a super unusual career, but that's somebody I think about like that who just like, he sort of became a legend just because he never stopped doing what he was doing. I mean, there are tons of points during his career where you could say like, he's a not successful. You know, right, like living out of his van and just like selling tapes. And so, yeah, staying with it is really the only option that I see for like finding success in whatever shape that is.
15 years I ran to save myself. I struggled through the flood, although I cannot swim. You know, you tell.
You mention in the book that you are deaf to lyrics, but because you focus on the music so much, which really resonated with me because I'm the same way, and I'm also a writer. Like, I don't write as much as you do, but I do write, so I consider myself somewhat of a writer. But I also, yeah, I ever since I was a kid, could never pay attention to the content of lyrics, and I hear it as another part of the music. So yeah, I just wanted to let you know that there are other people who fit that same paradigm. And
I appreciate that. And it's funny, you know, you're not the first person to tell me that after reading the book. But like when I was writing it, I did think like, I'm crazy, you know? And like, mm-hmm. I'm sure it's the same with you. Like, yeah, we can hear the lyrics, but like once it's like, you know, I think of it as like, you know, when you look at the stars, like you can see them better out of the periphery of your vision. It's like, that's how it is for the lyrics. Like, I can't stay focused on them because they're off to the side. It's all about the melody and the arrangement and the instrumentation. So, again, in the book, I mentioned it does change for me if the lyrics are really good, though, you know, I know a lot of the lyrics, you know, in like Nebraska, you know, the Bruce Springsteen record, or like there are certain writers. And so part of it, too, is like in a lot of the music we listen to, the words are simply sort of like vessels to deliver the melody, you know. Mm-hmm. Right. And then that when that math changes, I do feel my sort of like ears changing. But yeah, man, terrible with lyrics. I have no idea what people are saying including in the bands I'm in, especially in the bands I'm in.
Yeah, I actually don't know most of the lyrics to Grand Children Songs, the band that I spent, you know, 10 years previous being in. I don't know most of the lyrics, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, you're preaching the choir. I mean, part of me, it was sort of cool to go back and look at the lyrics, at Athenaeum lyrics, when I was writing this book. Like, I think part of me maybe was like insulating myself. Like, I don't even want to know what he's talking about, right? Like, what if it's not good, you know? I sort of know the lyrics, but I went back and looked at a bunch of them and I was like, wow, like, these are great, you know? I mean, this isn't poetry, but like, man, Mark, you're in high school and this is like excellent workman-like drafting, like, it's like chiseling marble, blowing it, like, got the job done, like, telling a story, interesting perspective. So it was a nice sort of return to some of that, to get a new perspective on something that I ostensibly sort of knew every note of.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel like that? Because I feel like most people who do primarily pay attention to the lyrics, I feel like most of their emotional connection is probably through the semantic content of the words. Right. But how do you feel like that changes your emotional connection to music? Because I would guess, because it's that way with me, I would guess that it is like the music itself stirs up the emotion in me and produces emotions that aren't necessarily correlated one-to-one with like your regular mental emotions of like sadness, happiness. It's like it can be like very ineffable sometimes, and it can be just like make you tear up and like not know why. this isn't inspiring or sad or any like single emotion that I can put my finger on. So yeah, what has been your experience with that and music, your emotional connection?
Right. So I think about this, the difference between crafting a story and like crafting a song or a lyric that resonates. And I agree with your point completely. And the way I think about it sometimes is like, even if I don't know the lyrics to a song, you know, I might know one lyric and it's very impressionistic, right? So think about like Night Swimming by REM, right? Like, I don't know what he's talking about, but like Night Swimming, oh man, like that's so evocative then with the musical mood that's set, like just that one lyrical sort of brushstroke is enough to conjure, you know, things. Of course, it's like more related to, I guess, a poetic reading than it would be with prose, right? Where with prose, it's really like crafting the magic trick of manipulating your attention and emotions through a whole journey. And like the reason I think about that sort of impressionistic thing is those like real emotional resonance that I'll have with songs are mostly songs that are sung in English. You know, I listen to songs that, you know, people sing in all sorts of languages, but like all I need is that one brushstroke of an image or something for me to sort of connect to it on a deeper level, even if I don't know what the rest of like the lyrics are. But it is weird to be a writer and to be sort of lyric blind. But it's funny, I was doing a book event with Mac McCann from Superchunk, who'd read the book, and we were doing like a, you know, back and forth thing, and he's like, lyrical deaf. You're not lyrically deaf. That's the fibromyalgia of like of musicianship. And I was like, well, okay, you're right. I can hear lyrics, but it is funny to me how many people think that we're crazy.
Yeah. Speaking of prose, I also wanted to ask, because you wrote, there are at least two chapters in the book that are written sort of, you frame it in the chapter head title as like a how-to, and then you write it in second person present tense of like, this is how, but you're just saying like exactly what you did. And so I'm just wondering, it just made me curious, like, and part of this is, I remember writing a story in present tense in high school, and my teacher, like when she was giving the assignment, she said it like, you know, short stories have to be in past tense. And I was like realizing in my head what was going on. I was like, oh wait, this is in present tense. It's like already in my head. And I'm reading it to myself in present tense. And she was like, no, like it would probably be better in past tense. So you know, I'm going to dock you if you do your grade, if you do that. And I did it anyway. And she did dock me just one point and was like, it was like, I still think this would be better in past tense, but it made me curious about like what your choice was, what the intention was, or was it just like for fun?
Well, no, I'm glad you asked. And also as for your high school teacher, as you know, God bless her. I'm sure she's doing great work, but that is not good advice. Right. You can of course write fiction in present tense, but so I had drafted a bunch of chapters for this book. A lot of them, you know, operate sort of independently as essays, and so I was trying to just like write some questions that I had, right? And I would write an essay about each question. I was letting it take form like that, and I shared some of those with my friend Darren from Benfold 5. And who he's like the incredible reader, right? He's like my friend who's like reads more than anybody I know. And he's a great reader of my work. And he had a great response. He read some of the essays. He's like, yeah, Nick, these are real interesting. But man, I want to know about when it was really good. And I was like, oh, yeah. Like, if I'm going to write about some questions I have about something that was great, I have to establish when it was great. And so then I started thinking, like, how do I start the book with like a foundation of like when things were the best? And then I started thinking like, you know, a lot of people ask you like, oh, how did you do it? How did you get a record deal? And then, of course, there's no like single answer. And so that's how I came up with the idea of writing the chapter as a how-to guide. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it also... And I tell my students this, like lots of times when I'm talking to my students, my creative writing students, what I'm really doing is talking to myself about the project I'm writing on, you know? So right, like, right. It really does help me. And this is something I do with my students to let them think about a topic a new way. Like, let's write a how-to guide on how to like, you know, fall in love or something. And so I was talking about it with my students one day and I'm like, oh, I'm gonna try approaching this like that. And what it helped me do was that first chapter, what's the second chapter after the book? There's a prologue, but then the first chapter is how to have success with your band in North Carolina in the 90s or something. Mm-hmm. It allowed me to cover a ton of time, right? Whereas mm-hmm. like if I had listened to your high school teacher and I was writing a sort of a traditional past tense, like narrative, first person, I feel like I wouldn't have been able to like jump time with as much flexibility as I did in this weird format, right? Mm-hmm. And so I could cover years in two paragraphs all of a sudden in this weird format, and it didn't seem weird. And so for me, it was just all of a sudden a way for me to like get into that topic. And then, you know, it also allowed me to then at the end of the book have a closing chapter when the band reunites, right? And so it's sort of like I bring that form back as a sort of like, you know, it's like repeating the chorus at the end. Right. It's the same format, right?
When birds hate mice and mice hate birds, fly away somewhere else. Conflict resolved. When you live in town, it's a long way out. All the cars go round, but they
How has your career, both creative career and just like, you know, teaching, I guess, or just like regular career, how has that interacted with becoming a father? Like that transition, I know a lot of people that I know who are creative people, you know, end up doing the stay at home parent thing because it's like, you know, I have an unsure like career, and my wife has a steady career, so obviously if somebody's going to stay home, it's going to be me, you know.
Sure.
And if I went out and got a job, I would be spending all my money on like that entire salary would just go to childcare, so it's right. Gonna cancel each other out. I was wondering what was your personal experience with that, and you know, the trajectory of that.
Well, you know, one of the great things about the job I have now, you know, as a professor, I just have to go in 2 days a week, you know, and teach two classes a semester. It's like a pretend job. I can't believe I get paid for this, right?
Right.
But so very early on when I got my first job as a professor, it is just amazing because it solves so much of just what you're talking about, because I was around a lot more, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there was a stretch when I left grad school before I had, before I got my first teaching job, where I was working a 9-to-5 that I, you know, couldn't stand, you know?
Right.
And I didn't like being out of the house. You know, I wanted to be around my daughter and be helping out. But then like the short answer there, I scored. I got so lucky, you know, I got this job. It's amazing. But then like also as far as how parenting has affected like me as an artist, I'm sure you know exactly what I'm talking. I'm like, I didn't know anything about anything before I had a child. Like, how did I write anything of intelligence or have a single like interesting thought? So like, that's where all the good stuff for me has come from, I feel like, as far as content-wise. I feel like up to the point where I became a father, I was like getting deep into explorations of style, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, opened up my world in such a great way that, you know, as you know, with like writing, if you're writing about something important, it makes the writing better, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, once you become a parent, you have access to all this, you know, all these wider thoughts and perspectives on the world that you didn't before. And of course, we know tons of artists who are like incredible who don't have children. You know, everybody has their own path. That's, for me, it just helped me, I feel like, just become smart for the first time or realize how dumb I was about everything.
Well, I feel like it also, because it takes up so much of your extra time, right? That it makes you condense the things that you really want to do. It makes you it makes the time that you have to spend on the things that you really want to do more condensed and therefore more focused, or have to go way harder during that little available time.
Right. So I had finished my first book, which was basically a collection of short stories. And I had gotten an agent. The book didn't sell. And that's when my wife got pregnant. And I remember thinking, I was like, I have to finish this novel. I'd started a second book. I'm like, I got to finish this by the first week in August. And it was great, right? Because it just I worked so hard on that book. I didn't even remember writing that book. I had 9 to 5. I would wake up at 5 a.m. every morning, write from 5 to 7. And I finished the book. And then it was because of that pressure, even before Frances had arrived, right? I was I got to get this book done. Thank God I did. I was right. I did need to get it done then. Right. And then in an amazing just coincidence of timing, my agent actually got me a 2-book deal on the day my daughter was born. He called. It's the only time I could get that call and say, hey, man, I can't talk right now. The only day where I'm like, whatever, dude, I got something else going on. Yeah. But and then after that, I continued to write from 5 to 7 in the morning because that was my window. And that really helped. I saw this documentary about a boxer. It's so stupid. I don't even know. It was on PBS or something. But he would train real early. And I was like, that looks so cool. I'm going to do that. I'm going to wake up at 5 a.m. like that boxer. And I'm going to write so hard. It's so stupid. But it really worked for me that I found this little window. And so I don't wake up at 5 a.m. to write anymore. But I did until I could get those books published, which was what helped me get this, a job that gave me flexibility.
Well, that's all the questions that I have for this. Do you have anything else that you want to add that comes up?
No, I was excited to talk to you just because of the Skeleton Key connection. Yeah. I've connected with a lot of people through different bands from my past because of this book. And sort of as we were talking about the Skeleton Key, window is a little bit smaller. And so I was super excited to hear from somebody who had a Skeleton Key connection. That Skeleton Key holds a real special place in my heart. So thanks for reaching out.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Writing Podcast. We're an independent literary site and nonprofit organization based in the Boston area, but with contributors from around the world. Since our founding in 2010, we've relied on donations to keep publishing and podcasting. To donate to TW, you can use the donate button on the rss.com page of this podcast or visit talkingwriting.com/donate. And of course, feel free to drop us a line at editor@talkingwriting.com.